Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Julia Pashaud, and she will be speaking on Find Your Voice Too. So let's listen in on Julia Pashaud.
This class is pretentiously titled Speak Your Truths. I say pretentiously because in my many years of doing theater, I sometimes wonder how I, as a teacher, would have any better corner on it than you would. But I do think that we're going to get at some things today that hopefully can help you address your practice in daily living. And that's what we will talk about. A couple of things. We're going to discuss the concept of truth first, and then we're going to talk about the discipline that's behind that word. And I don't mean discipline in the strict sense of the pejorative sense of discipline. I mean discipline in the sense of practice, of an ordered practice. So first of all, what is truth? Hi, come on in. Truth in this context, to me, this is the to me part, has to do with your corner of experience and your corner of the universe, how you express that, how you see it. I'm not here to tell you what the sort of black and white version of truth is. I think there are plenty of people who've chosen to do that for us. And I think you'll be attracted to the truths that resound for you. And I do think there are fundamental truths. Obviously, working here, I believe in Christianity. That's a fundamental truth that informs my life, and that is one that works for me. However, my take on Christianity, my perspective may not resound for you. And I think it's important that in your practice and your discipline will take you to those places, you discover how that is expressed for you. Why create? That's the second question. Why create? Because this has been a class on writing and creative practice. And I just want to share some thoughts from Madeleine L'Engle's book, Reflections on Faith and Art. It's a lovely little book if you have an opportunity. There's an also a book in the bookstore called Free Play by Stephen Nachmanovich that you might like. And L'Engle writes, in the creative act, we can experience the same freedom we know in dreams. This happens as I write a story. I am bound by neither time nor space. She talks about a few things that she's worked on. I know those distant galaxies to which Meg Murray went with Charles Wallace and Calvin. And she talks about her characters. I live in 17th century Portugal with Mariana Alcoforado. But this freedom comes only when, as in a dream, I do not feel that I have to dictate and control what happens. I dream sometimes that I am in a beautiful white city I have never seen in quote-unquote real life, but I believe it. I also believe in the planet Uriel with its beautiful flying creatures, and also in that other planet where are found the unicorn hatching grounds. When we are writing or painting or composing, we are, during the time of creativity, freed from normal restrictions and are opened to a wider world where colors are brighter, sounds clearer, and people more wondrously complex than we normally realize. I'll repeat that last part. When we are writing or painting or composing, and I would add creatively living, we are during the time of creativity, freed from normal restrictions and are opened to a wider world where colors are brighter, sounds clearer, and people more wondrously complex than we normally realize. I believe that aesthetic practice, and I don't care what you define as your aesthetic practice, but any aesthetic practice allows us to live more fully by being more joyful, by being in the moment, by being more aware and attuned to our environment and our lives and our hearts and our minds. I believe it's a way of integrating all that we feel in all that we do. It's walking the walk as well as talking the talk. And that's why I do it. That's why I do theater. Now, let's talk a little bit about having what it means to have a voice. Find your voice. I lost my voice. Can you imagine? That implies that it's lost. I'm sure you all have a voice, and I'm sure you all exercised it greatly in your years of living. However, When I talk about having a voice, I talk about naming experience, about actually putting words to what it is that you do believe, feel, think. And I believe there's great power in naming your experience. And I'm sure that you have all sort of been aware in the last several years there's been a lot of testimonies from survivors of sexual assault or incest. A lot of those voices have risen up. And what those individuals will often say is that just the act of being able to name what happened to them empowers them to move forward. Okay, it's as if they've been walking in a circle for many years and suddenly they're walking forward in a straight line again. Their life is no longer on the hamster wheel. I like to call it on the hamster wheel today. And I feel like a hamster someday. But it's a matter of giving yourself the power to claim what it is you've done or have been through, and giving that some authority in the world. Now, there's also a flip side to the power part, and that is the responsibility. Once you have become a namer, you are responsible for what you have named. For example, if you name yourself as artist, you have a responsibility as an artist. If you name yourself as a wife, parent, you have a responsibility inherent with that title. And there's good things and bad things in that. But it's important to know that there is, with power comes responsibility. Finally, art, because these are all the things we're going to play with today, creativity slash art, artistic expression. And when I talk about expression or art, I'm talking about everything that you do. When I say art, I mean the artistic practice of your life. Let's talk a little about the cultural perception of art. There's two kind of reigning camps. There's the reigning camp that says that art must be useful, the craft camp, that if it, you know, what does it do? I was throwing a pot, and a gentleman was throwing a pot beside me, and I said, well, what are you going to make? He said, I don't know. And he made something, and it had a wrinkle. And I said, well, that's actually very interesting. Are you going to keep that? He says, no, doesn't do anything. Don't want it. And he threw it away. There's also a group that says that art must be beautiful, that the satisfaction comes in its beauty. I tend to think that it does both. However, I do think that there is an inherent problem in both camps. With the usefulness camp, if it doesn't perform a function that we can look at, if it doesn't print on the page, or if it doesn't write on the page, or if it doesn't make something that can be used, it suddenly loses its ability in society to be a contributing partner. Abraham Maslow, how many of you have heard of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs? For years talked about the five needs, which were social, basic, physiological. I'll start at the beginning, gosh, that would be good. Maslow talked about a pyramid or a hierarchy of needs, and originally he had five of them. And the nice thing about cultural theorists is that they tend to continue their work and their thinking. And he posited that we all have basic needs that must be fulfilled, that they work in a hierarchy, which means that the most basic needs must be fulfilled before we can move to higher order needs. And that it will always work that way. If your basic needs aren't being met, you can not move forward. And he began by saying that we have, first of all, physiological needs. And physiological needs are those needs that have to do with basic nurture, water, food. Okay, what do I have to survive? Sleep. Then he went on to say that we also have safety needs, the need to be protected and away from the elements. Then he went on to posit that once those needs are met, we can go on to fulfill what are known as our social needs, the needs to have community and company. After those three needs are met, then we go into the needs that have to do with ourself. And the first is the need to feel that we have value. And once we have value, we can begin to find out who we are, the who we are needs. Well, Maslow, in his work, discovered that these needs are still holding. They still hold. But there are two more needs that he, in his later work, discovered to be true. The need to know, and the need for beauty. And I find it interesting that the uppermost point, or the apex of the pyramid, is the need for beauty. It doesn't have to do anything, but we do have a need for beauty in our lives. If you think about Holden, and why you come here, how many of you are first-timers at Holden? Oh, wow, not too many. That's exciting. And I'm excited that those of you who are first-timers are here. If you think about the people who come again and again, I often think that one of the reasons that they come is not only that it's a community of praise, but that it's a community of praise set in such a glorious setting. That in some ways, somewhat difficult trek up the mountain, you know, this sort of torturous, okay, boat ride, bus ride, okay. Suddenly, you're in the village, and it's pristine. It's very pretty, yes, but it's also glorious. And when I came into the village, I went, oh, whoa, you know, something in me opened up. And I do think it is fatuous to say that it should just do something. That together, the elements combined to fulfill a deeply rooted set of needs in all of us. Okay. Well, all of you have various forms of expressions, and today we're going to be talking about those expressions as a discipline, and I like to think of discipline as prayer. Much like the Shakers thought about their discipline as a prayerful expression to God daily, as a form of praise, I'd like to help kind of convince you or walk you through the argument that what you do in your everyday life is not, there is nothing too small. There is nothing too small, that everything that you do has some value and content in the eyes of God and in your own sort of growth as a person with a voice. Well, moving on to talk about this idea of prayer. We all know prayer as a ritual, and ritual within the context of going to church. And okay, this is when we stay. Thanks be to God. This is the stand up, sit down part. But I like to think, I'd like to take us a little farther in the conceptualizing of ritual. I'll be moving up and down. So these people will hear. That is it. Don't sort of hear us going back and forth. I'd like to think of ritual as operating on a spectrum, as a movement from habituated action or habit to sacrament. It can be anything from the way that you brush your teeth in the morning to taking the blood and the body of Christ. Okay, there's a broad spectrum for defining ritual. And I'm pleased that there's a broad spectrum because that gives us a lot of room to work in looking at the ritual of your lives. Okay, and that's one thing that we hopefully can examine today. I taught a class early this year in the spring called the Magical Mystery Tour, and we talked a great deal about rituals. A lot of the students were very interested in this concept of ritual, but many of them couldn't understand how it was that their lives were ritualed, I guess the word would be. And so one of my colleagues, went up and said, ritual. Okay. And we did an exercise on handshaking and developing handshakes. Ritual is the ordering of our space, it's the ordering of our time, and it's the ordering of our symbols. Okay? It's basic elements put together in a way to create sense and order. You know, one of the interesting things that Langle talks about in her book is that art allows us to bring order to the chaos. That in many ways, the universe isn't chaotic, but it can seem chaotic. And so as human beings, we like to bring order and sense through ritualizing, or enritualizing. I don't know what would the verb form of ritual be? And it is through that ordering that we see more clearly. So let's look at this idea of ritual and ordering. How do you know what to say? Okay? How do you know what to say? Langle, in her book, and I keep referring to it because I just happened upon it, and I'm rather in love with her. her work. She talks about walking on water. It's about reflections about being a Christian artist. One of the recurrent themes that she is drawn to and that I am drawn to as well is this idea of listening. Listening to your, it's gone now, but finding your voice. Listening to your voice, listening to the voice of God coming to you, and asking. And I like that idea of conversation. For a long time, prayer for me was this one-sided conversation where I would ask, and I wouldn't hear a thing. What? What? You know? And it didn't work for me. The idea of prayer just didn't, you know, this sort of regular conception, sort of normalized conception of prayer just did not work for me. And so I began saying to myself, well, obviously you're praying because several of your prayers have been answered. So what's the problem here? And I began to realize that perhaps it was in my static conception of what prayer means. Prayer, to me, I began to realize, means conversation. It means dialogue. It means reflection. It means interaction with God. And I began to look at how many interactions do I have and begin to characterize them. And I'd like to kind of encourage you. I'd like to encourage you to think for yourselves. How many kinds of interactions do you find yourself having? There are conversations. There are dialogues. There are monologues, journaling. There, for me, the interaction that I have with the elements, say in pottery, and I'm using my hands because I'm an actor, so I'm thinking about it, but pottery, anything that I do with my hands is a conversation with the material. Okay? And that to me is prayerful. When I began to think of this idea of conversation, it began to open up the whole spectrum of what it was to pray. Now, prayer for me involves a listening posture. Finding voice for me involves a listening posture. And this brings me to the concept of mindfulness. Have any of you read Thich Nhat Hanh's books? Thich Nhat Hanh. And don't ask me to spell his name because it's got way too many syllables. But he's written a book called The Miracle of Mindfulness. And this is one of his latter books. Early books, but in The Miracle of Mindfulness, Ten talks about the idea of mindfulness, and that is being present. And it's certainly easy to talk about being present. Oh, be present now. Be here. Okay. But the best way I can do it is to illustrate it with a story. He was talking to a friend who was eating an orange. And the friend was peeling the orange, and was talking about all these wonderful plans he had to take a new job. And he was holding the last slice in his hand and turned to him and said, "What are you eating?" The point of the story is that he was totally unconscious of the fact that he was eating as he was speaking. That he had not been present to any of that meal. And in many ways, although his body had received nourishment, he had not received the nourishment of the meal because he had not been present to it. How many of you have ever done dishes? Oh. How many of you do anything you can to avoid doing dishes? Because it seems like such an unpleasant task. It's a recurrent. I think the unpleasantness comes in the recurrence of the task. What Ten posits is that even in the most mundane of tasks, we can be present to the moment. We can feel the water. We can look at the light on the bubbles. We can feel the breeze come in. We can feel the sun on our face. We can watch the world around us. Because we're brought to those dishes at that moment in time. And at that moment in time, that's all we have. Another way to illustrate it would be to look at the sort of linear conception that we live with in this culture of time. We live with three arbitrary delineations called past, present, and future. There are certain cultures that have no delineation of, and a lot of Native American cultures are like this, have no delineation that's artificial. Everything is at one. Okay? In The Miracle of Mindfulness, what Thich Nhat Hanh posits is that this is experience that's gone. This has not happened yet. This is what we have. If you're here, or you're here, you're nowhere. You are nowhere. You're not living. You're not in the moment. Now, that's not to say that we cannot go back and be present to the past. That's an equal kind of presence, but it's a choice. I'm sure all of you know people who choose to live in the past, and therefore miss their present. It's a very different choice to go back to past experience and live with it for a short amount of time to enrich what you have present in the present. Okay, so he talks about this idea of presence. Well, how do you achieve presence of mind? It's very difficult. We live in a culture that encourages us to be anywhere but where we are, because certainly to be where you are is not satisfying, because you don't have all the stuff you need to be where you are. And, you know, if you don't buy stuff, the culture is going to collapse because the economy will fall down and we'll all die. And, you know, on one level, we laugh a bit, but those are the kinds of messages that we're pressured with all the time. And unfortunately, what that encourages us to do is to not rest in what we have in the moment. I would say that the answer is simple but very difficult, and that is simply to do it. Hopefully I can give you some small tastes of that with a few exercises today. But only you can find what brings you to the present, whether it's meditative practice, whether it's writing, whether it's walking. Every one of you will have a different trigger that will take you to the present more fully. I will give you a few touches of that today in some examples and exercises in just a few moments. Okay, so we talked about the idea of art. We talked about the idea of presence. We've talked about the idea of prayer. And I want to talk now about the discipline, the major part of the bulk of what we'll talk about. And we've brought up the Shakers. The Shakers believed that everything that you did was a praise to God, and to do it meant to do it well, to do it completely, to be with it. All of you have different practice, or medium, as I like to call them, and there are several. There's everything from the classic arts, whether it's writing, cooking, pottery, music, dance, theater, literature, but it can also be the more mundane household arts, cleaning, nurturance. It can be a career choice. It can be engineering. It can be teaching. It can be anything that you choose to make it. It can be conversations. It can be a well-written letter. It can be your journaling. It can be a celebration of community. It can be hospitality, how you choose to open your home, or how you choose to create a ritual, such as a wedding or a childbirth. It can be just a community potluck. It can be a number of things. Media can change. But what I'd like to do is kind of touch on practice and then do a few exercises. As I've constructed it, and this is certainly not flawless and not complete, but this helps me to delineate, there are four basic levels of practice that all of you have encountered, I believe. And the first one is naive. That would be the, I do it because I love it. I'm not an expert, but boy, I sure like it. You know, whether it's writing or journaling, or I'm a hack cook, or I'm just learning the computer, but boy, I sure like it. The next is the apprenticeship stage, and most people need to go through the phases. They need to start at the basic and go. There are geniuses in the world, and I truly believe it. There are people who are suddenly, you know, at the final level of artisanship. But apprenticeship is when you know that you love this craft, and you want to become better at it. And so you find someone to mentor you in the craft. you find someone to take you farther in it, because you know that there are more discoveries you have to make within this medium. The third level, practitioner. Practitioner is when you are acknowledged as a person who is operating autonomously in the field. You're a colleague. You have expertise. You may not have all of the expertise, but you've got a good deal and you're still learning. And finally, artisan. And I believe these two can operate concomitantly. And an artisan is a person who serves to mentor, a person who is an apprentice. Now, just a few notes about levels. There is a chronology here. You move through this, but I'm not inferring any kind of a hierarchy. And you can do a number of these at once. I don't think for your purposes it is any better to be an artisan or a naive practitioner. It's what suits your needs. And please, 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 I hope if you leave with nothing, you leave with that. If you get great satisfaction from making cross-stitch of ducks, you know, that you want to give to your kids in kindergarten, you know, and that's what you do, then do it. Or if you get great satisfaction from learning how to paint black velvet paintings of Elvis, then you do it, and you do it joyfully. I was trying to think of what would be a naive practitioner, but there are great black velvet painters, I must say. I don't do it, so I'm not going to make fun of it. But all of these have importance in the practice of finding your voice, and if I dare say it, God's eyes. You know, there is no gift too small, and I really truly believe that, people. That sounds so true. Now, Natalie Goldberg's, for those of you who were here yesterday, we used some guidelines from Natalie Goldberg's book, Writing Down the Bones, which I think has great lessons for all kinds of practice, and I'd like to kind of use them as a guideline to talk about the idea of discipline. And again, I'm not thinking of discipline in respect of pejorative practice, but if you don't do it, you're going to curl up and die. I think that framing discipline in that way can deter interest, and it's not to say that discipline cannot be painful from time to time. Sometimes you don't want to sit down and write because what you have to write is so painful that you just don't want to do it, but it must be done in order to move you forward. That's a much different thing. Coming to that is much different than somebody behind you going, get to that piano now. For all of you parents, we will get to that piano now, and every day for the next 4 years, that's our agreement, okay? Sometimes you need the person behind you going, yes, I will, the poker. But discipline, in my viewpoint, and in this context, is internally motivated. It's a choice you make. It's walking the hard road for yourself, okay, because it can be hard. So I'm going to use these rules and then talk about them within the framework of practice and discipline. The first one is find a sweetheart. And she talks about the need to find a positive voice. Within this context, I think the first thing that is demanded is giving yourself a name. Choosing to name yourself, or choosing to be overt about your practice. Yes, I am a cook. Yes, I am a chef. Yes, I am a writer. Yes, I am a homemaker. Yes, I am a teacher. Even when you don't feel ready to claim the name. The sweetest thing you can do for yourself is to give yourself no more invisibility. There's enough people, I think, willing to make individuals invisible. You, of all people, must be present, and by being present, put yourself out there. So, name yourself. Other thoughts, give yourself credit. Credit where credit is due. I'm moving forward. And up-talk yourself. Yes, I'm not just a writer, but I am a writer, okay? No just anything. Second rule is keep moving. Goldberg talks about it within the context of writing, where she says, keep the hand moving. Even if you don't have anything to say, don't scratch it out. Just write the same word over and over again until the next word comes. In the context of discipline and practice, there are a few thoughts here. First of all, choose a medium to work in, and then change it. Try something new. The lessons that you've learned within one context, whether it's cooking, or sewing, or teaching, or ministry, or nursing, or whatever it is that you do, doctoring, healthcare, you will take into the next medium. And what will happen is your practice will be enriched. You'll go back and renewed into the first choice, and the second choice will be more boundless because of the first, if that makes sense. And the principle continues. If you think of some of the great artists, like Pablo Picasso, Picasso was a visual artist, but he also wrote poetry. You know, he also cooked. There were a number of things that he chose to do, and I would dare say that you all have a number of practices within you to experiment with. The second thing to think about is characterizing your practice, defining what it is that your discipline is going to be. For a long time, I would, not having found my sweetheart, thrash myself because I wasn't doing something the way everyone else did. I had a number of colleagues in graduate school who were sort of like, 20 mule team borax. I'm going to write this paper, yeah, I'm sitting down 6 hours a day, I'm going to write this paper, yeah. And they would just, I would be shamed. Well, yeah, I got my books and stuff, but I'm going to write it tonight, you know, sort of. And what I realized was that my practice was very much different from theirs. And so what I've learned to do is characterize my practice in a very different way. And I use the running metaphor. In terms of my practice as an artist and a practitioner, period, I am a sprinter. I do things very intensely, very quickly, and in a very short period of time. Then I have a period of rest. And when I rest, I rest. I often said, oh, I'm so lazy, and I sit around. But what happens is in my rest periods, I gestate. I will read, and then I won't do anything. I'll go cook or do something. As my friend says, you put your left brain out of commission. You just use the right brain. And you let stuff gel in there, and suddenly when I sat down, boom, 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 there it was. Very intensive. A very intensive practice. And so for me, the idea of a long-distance runner does not work, because I am not a long-distance runner. I peter out. I am a sprinter. What's your practice? Think about characterizing your practice in order that you not give yourself flack, you know, in order that you get the most out of what it is that you do. Ah, here we go. Fun stuff. This is the hard one. Don't think. And don't edit. We're going to try a couple of exercises here. These are called pacemakers. These are things that you can do to kind of become one with your environment and feel presence, okay? What I'd like you to do is just sit with your hands up in your lap. Just find a comfortable position. And just take a big breath. Breathe into your back, as they say. Think about breathing into those intercostal muscles. But fill the belly with air is another way to think of it. Okay, just shut your eyes and feel yourself breathing. Become aware of your breath. And we're going to expand, and then when we release the breath, we're going to release it on a slow and steady shh sound, sort of a. And just breathe normally. And these are called cleansing breaths, and they're very good at making you very aware of where you are right there. Okay? It's a way of sort of getting out the crap. I tell students, like when I teach, when I teach acting, that leave their stuff at the door, leave their baggage at the door, because it's very hard to do acting when you're somewhere else. It's extremely hard. It's hard to do anything when you're somewhere else, but boy, is it hard to act, because it's about being in a body. And we often do cleansing breath, because cleansing breath sort of brings them right back to the present, and even if they're uptight about something, gives you a chance to kind of let it go just a bit, okay? So cleansing breath. The next one is if you're in a group, and we're going to do a little thing called group harmony. No, you don't have to sing to make group harmony, but this is particularly good for focusing in a larger group. What we're going to do is expand. We're going to release on a note. Doesn't matter what note, sort of an ah sound. And we'll just adjust slightly till we hear a harmony that we like. It doesn't have to be major. You don't even have to know music to do this. We're just going to make a sound that's okay with us. Okay? That's all it is. There is no quiz at the end of the hour, so expand. This exercise is because you feel yourself. You feel the vibration of the group. You're very present to other people, you know, through vibration and through the harmony, through what everybody is doing, the resonance. It's another nice way to be present to the group, and it's good with two people. It's good with four. It's good with 15. It's interesting. I use these exercises a lot, and my students start doing them themselves, and I'm always surprised and shocked. What? Like these things? But they do work. They do work. Okay, so group harmony and breathing. Next, become present to your environment. What we're going to do is we're just going to shut our eyes. We're going to listen for a minute. Do is I'd have you take the hand away and then I'd have you draw that section as a way of being aware of what it is that you've taken in. But we won't for lack of time, unfortunately. There are a couple of things I still want to do yet. But these are excellent kinds of small, quick exercises that you can do before you go into something, particularly artistic practice. Say you write, say you you are an artist, a visual artist of some kind, just to get you back where you are. Say, oh, where am I? I'm here, I'm now, okay? Or any time that you feel that you need to be present. Say you're a psychotherapist, and you have had a terribly long day, and you know it's after lunch, you're tired, and you've got a client coming in. You take 5 minutes, and you look at your hand, or you listen to the environment, or you put a fan on your face, and you just become present through your breathing. And what happens more often than not is that you're refreshed to continue. These are pacemakers. They pace you through the day. They remind you that you're in the moment.
I have a question.
Ma'am.
So sometimes if I'm feeling confused or it's late and I'm going through I'm getting groceries and I can't find my keys.
Oh, yeah.
Is that kind of, that's when you need to be a person. How do you do that? Let me look up my hand.
You know what I used to do? I stop and I breathe. Have you had children?
Mm-hmm.
Lamas. I know a lot of people who do Lamas. Just as a way of getting more present. But I had a friend who would always go, and people would look at him, but he'd always sort of focus on what his lips were doing. Just find a way to put you right back there in the moment. If I'm running around and I'm frenetic, I just stop. I go, okay, obviously this is not working.
It's like that orbiting feeling.
Yeah. And more often than not, I've missed everything because I can't focus anyway. It's like I used to wait tables, and if there were too many tables and too much stimulus, what would happen would be my brain would go, after about the seventh customer, I would just go, I can't do this anymore. And I'd have to sort of go, okay, now where was I? But you just stop in the middle of the room. That's what I would recommend, and that does work for me. Next rule. Oh, I hate this pen. I always pick it up. Rules. These are all the rules insofar as you want to use them. The first rule is you can always break the rules. Let go and go for the jugular. Don't be afraid of voicing the dirty, nasty, icky stuff. You know what Jung calls your shadow self? Because you've got one, I hate to tell you. And it's perfectly fine within a context that works for you to bring those things out. Doesn't mean you have to share them. All right? I'm going to give you a paper.
real quick exercise, and you can use, pass out the Bibles. You can draw the Bible. If you have a pen, I'd like you to use one. If not, I'll grab one for you.
So, just one. You might want to do it in your journal.
This is called body mapping. It's a really quick exercise. It comes from Ken Deichwald in his book Body Mind. If you've ever heard of him, he's a geriatrician. I guess he studies geriatric science. I'm making up all these words today, but hey, I can because I found my voice. What are you gonna do?
I need a pen.
Oh, ma'am. Yes. Let's pass these around. Just pass that box around. What you're gonna do is And normally the way I do this, and they make great, big, wonderful posters, is I'll take something like newsprint, a roll of newsprint, and I'll get one that's big enough for your body. And you just lay on the print, and then you have somebody trace you, okay? You use bright colored markers if you want. It's great for kids. It's really good if you're doing something where you want people to go back to childhood, because childhood, as I said, the past is a wonderful resource for present experience, as long as you stay present, okay? As long as you don't dwell and go, oh, why did I let Bobby Smith hit me with that rock when I was 7? No, it's about going back and saying, oh, I did this and this happened, and now where am I now with this? But we're gonna do it in miniature. What I want you to do is just draw sort of a, well, give yourself shoulders. Draw sort of a body for yourself. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and you can continue this on your own. The first question I have for you is, you don't have to put this on the map, what was your favorite age? Everyone usually has one, and often it's either, you know, from adolescence or childhood. Maybe it's from, you know, later than that, but pick an age that was really positive and fun, has great associations for you. One that is vivid is best. Like, I remember 7 for some reason really well, okay? So pick an age, and just in your mind's eye, close your eyes if you want, you don't have to, see a picture of yourself at that age that may be from an actual photograph or an event. When you're with somebody, give yourself somebody else in the picture if that helps you, an animal, to see yourself, if that helps. And I will ask you questions about that age. They will refer to that age, and then anywhere on your map you can draw symbols or you can answer these questions in whatever way you feel is appropriate. The first question, what was your favorite smell? What was your favorite smell at this age? One of the reasons I think body map is useful is you can take any time of your life and you can make it present as a writing resource, as a working resource. Say that you have a particular experience that you think you need to sort through or use as an artistic resource, you can draw it up to the present using the map. And it will help you sort through some things and to make images and visceral things clearer, which really is the root of any kind of practice, I think, whether it's artistic. It's always in the body. You know, whether it's cooking is about food, which is about the stomach. Art is about experience, which is about in the body. It's usually about experience, which comes back to this, okay? Last rule, and there is more to do with these maps, but we're gonna kind of pass on. But I'll be glad to answer questions when we're all done. Last rule, and it's a good one, I think. And there are several ways to not stop. I'll give you 3 big ones. The first one is to teach or lead others even before you're ready, quote unquote. I'm not ready to do that. Too bad. You're probably more ready than you know. We had a person here last week, and I asked her to be a section leader in choir, and she goes, oh, and I said, oh, you go, you'll be fine. And her husband said, oh, you'll be fine. And then afterwards she came and she said, I was fine. Okay. I spent a lot of time last week doing vocal leading, and that's not normally what I do. I do theater, acting, that kind of stuff, getting up and talking. So it was very good for me. So lead even before you're ready.
You may fail,
but you may win. And failing is not such a big deal because often we learn bigger lessons through it.
I think when most people think about failure, they think about death, fundamentally.
Oh,
I always say, let's go back. Okay, what will happen if you forget your words during this thing? Oh, well, you know, people are going to laugh at me. What will happen if you laugh at me? Well, nobody will like me, okay? Nobody will like you anymore. Okay, what happens then? Well, they'll stop talking to me. Okay, they'll stop talking to you. Then what happens? Well, I don't know, then I'm going to die. You know, so at some level, they're afraid they're going to die. You won't die. There's somebody that loves you in the world. Think about all the people who hold you up in this life. Think about all the people who hold you up. There's a lot of them, I would guarantee you. Trust in that. And trust your abilities, because you'll learn more. You'll push farther. The second thing, join a group of people at similar levels of experience or slightly more, or apprentice yourself to somebody who can teach you something, whether it's cooking, whether it's writing, whether it's whatever you need to feel drawn to. Okay? And finally, advertise, either to get more experience or to find like-minded people. Make it known. Speak out loud. Okay, there's a couple of thoughts in our last few moments of some closure to this small session. I hope you, one of the things I hope you'll take away with you is that this is not an ideal practice. There is no ideal practice. These are just some thoughts for you that have come from my experience. The reason I have found these things useful is that they have given me sanity in what I think is an insane-making or crazy-making world. There's a lot of pressure, I think, in the world to not hear ourselves. And so I've spent a lot of time seeking ways to listen to myself more clearly. The second thought, use what you can. Throw everything else away. If it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for you. Third, change your tools every once in a while. If you're an artisan, go for a different set of tools. Say you like baking bread, but you use your little whipper mixer thing, get your hands dirty occasionally. If you're a carpenter and you've got great power tools, try a handsaw. Borrow your friend's mower and mow the lawn with the manual. Change your tools occasionally. And change your practice with occasion. It will help you. Another thought, fourth thought, show respect for your space and for your tools. One of the most fundamental ways that I can often tell that people aren't giving themselves respect is that they often trash their working space, okay? I work in the theater. We have 1,001 people coming in all the time. And it's very difficult for other people to work when somebody's left a mess. You're all adults, I know this. Well, almost all adults. And I'm sure for those of you who are parents, you spend a lot of time going, come back here. Now you're going to clean this mess up before you get to dinner. Okay, that sort of thing. The same is true of your working space. Give yourself a working space. Claim space just like you've claimed a name. Say, this is my writing table. This is where I will work. So give yourself space and give yourself the tools to practice and show respect for them. And finally, this is just a simple thought. Listen for the lessons that are out there. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Madeline L'Engle. And I'm going to give you a little exercise to take away. And it's a writing exercise, and you can use it for whatever you like. It's called modeling. What I'd like you to do, and it's just an interesting way to get into experience, is find a person whom you'd like to talk about. And look, I knew there were 12 people coming, or 10 people. With the modeling exercise, what I would like you to do is just randomly collect thoughts about a person whom you want to talk about, whether it's your grandmother, your child, your parent. And this poem by Meinecke, what is his name? Is a wonderful testimony to the contradictions in experience. Collect your thoughts about a person. You can cluster, if you know how to cluster, you may cluster, gather thoughts that way, and then gather them together into a poem and model. One nice way to increase your practice or to better find your voice is to find people who do something you like and model after them. Imitation is the best form of flattery. It's also a great teaching tool. The reason I give you this is it may be a way for you to tap into an experience or a person that you want have been talking, you may have wanted to talk about for some time. So I would encourage you to use this at your leisure to do that. I'm going to close with a thought from Madeline L'Engle. I think I'm going to close with a thought. Yeah, here we go. She broke her legs. She broke her foot or something. She broke her toe. And she kept getting these messages from her friend, slow down. And her friend sent her a picture of her covered bridge with the message, slow me down, Lord. And she said, good messages. When I'm constantly running, there's no time for being. When there's no time for being, there's no time for listening. I will never understand the silent dying of a green pineapple tree if I do not slow down and listen to what the Spirit is telling me. Telling me of the death of trees, the death of planets, the death of people, and what all these deaths mean in the light of love of the Creator who brought them all into being, who brought me into being and you. This questioning of the meaning of being and dying and being is behind the telling of stories around tribal fires at night, behind the drawing of animals on walls of caves, behind the singing of melodies of love in the spring, and of the death of green in autumn. It is a part of the deepest longing of the human psyche, a recurrent ache in the hearts of all of God's creatures. You have questions and you have stories to tell, and I hope that what we've touched on today is just a few ways for you to begin to hear those things in you, and perhaps some ways for you to appreciate the practice that you do have to offer in the world. That's it. I thank you. I hope you have a wonderful dinner and a day. Ask questions if you need them, and I'll see you later.